Chapter 4. Doubted to be authentic, wrote the London correspondent of the Bleeder, within the last year, that Lord John Russell bitterly regrets having made that explicit speech of last Monday. These are not roundabout phrases, these are plain words. What does Lord John Russell, apparently by accident, within 8 and 40 hours after their diffusion over the civilized globe, rises in his place in Parliament, and unblushingly declares that, if the occasion could arise 500 times, for his making that very speech, he would make it 500 times. Is there no conspiracy here? And is this combination against one who would be always right if he were not proved always wrong, to be endured in a country that boasts of its freedom and its fairness? But, the Tlesnivellian who now raises his voice against intolerable oppression, may be told that, after all, this is a political conspiracy. He may be told, forsooth, that Mr. Disraeli's being in it, that Lord Derby's being in it, that Mr. Bright's being in it, that every home, foreign, and colonial secretary's being in it, that every ministry's and every opposition's being in it, are but proofs that men will do in politics what they would do in nothing else. Is this the plea? If so, the rejoinder is, that the mighty conspiracy includes the whole circle of artists of all kinds, and comprehends all degrees of men, down to the worst criminal and the hangman who ends his career. For, all these are intimately known to the London correspondent of the Tlesnival Bleeder, and all these deceive him. Sir, put it to the proof. There is the Bleeder on the file, documentary evidence. Weeks, months, before the exhibition of the Royal Academy, the Bleeder's London correspondent knows the subjects of all the leading pictures, knows what the painters first meant to do, knows what they afterwards substituted for, what they first meant to do, knows what they ought to do and won't do, knows what they ought not to do and will do, knows to a letter from whom they have commissions, knows to a shilling how much they are to be paid. Now, no sooner is each studio clear of the remarkable man to whom each studio occupant has revealed himself as he does not reveal himself to his nearest and dearest bosom friend, than conspiracy and fraud begin. Alfred the Great becomes the Fairy Queen. Moses viewing the Promised Land turns out to be Moses going to the fair. Portrait of His Grace the Archbishop of Canterbury is transformed, as if by irreverent enchantment of the dissenting interest, into a favorite terrier, or cattle grazing, and the most extraordinary work of art in the list described by the Bleeder is coolly spawned out altogether, and asserted never to have had existence at all, even in the most shadow thoughts of its executant. This is vile enough, but this is not all. Picture buyers then come forth from their secret positions, and creep into their places in the assassin multitude of conspirators. Mr. Baring, after expressly telling the Bleeder's London correspondent that he had bought number 39 for 1,000 guineas, gives it up to somebody unknown for a couple of £100. The Marquis of Lansdowne pretends to have no knowledge, whatever, of the commissions to which the London correspondent of the Bleeder swore him, but allows a railway contractor to cut him out for half the money. Similar examples might be multiplied. Shame, shame, on these men! Is this England? Sir, look again at literature. The Bleeder's London correspondent is not merely acquainted with all the eminent writers, but is in possession of the secrets of their souls. He is versed in their hidden meanings and references, sees their manuscripts before publication, and knows the subjects and titles of their books when they are not begun. How dare those writers turn upon the eminent man and depart from every intention they have confided to him? How do they justify themselves in entirely altering their manuscripts, changing their titles, and abandoning their subjects? Will they deny, in the face of Tlesnival, that they do so? If they have such hardihood, let the file of the Bleeder strike them dumb. By their fruits they shall be known. Let their works be compared with the anticipatory letters of the Bleeder's London correspondent, and their falsehood and deceit will become manifest as the sun. It will be seen that they do nothing which they stand pledged to the Bleeders London correspondent to do. It will be seen that they are among the blackest parties in this black and base conspiracy. This will become apparent, sir, not only as to their public proceedings, but as to their private affairs. The outraged Lesnevelian who now drags this infamous combination into the face of day, charges those literary persons with making away with their property, imposing on the income tax commissioners, keeping false books, and entering into sham contracts. He accuses them on the unimpeachable faith of the London correspondent of the Lesnevel Bleeder, with whose evidence they will find it impossible to reconcile their own account of any transaction of their lives. The national character is degenerating under the influence of the ramifications of this tremendous conspiracy. Forgery is committed, constantly. A person of note, any sort of person of note, dies. The Bleeder's London correspondent knows what his circumstances are, what his savings are, if any, who his creditors are, all about his children and relations, and, in general, before his body is cold, describes his will. Is that will ever proved? Never. Some other will is substituted, the real instrument, destroyed. And this, as has been before observed, is England. Who are the workmen and artificers, enrolled upon the books of this treacherous league? From what funds are they paid, and with what ceremonies are they sworn to secrecy? Are there none such? Observe what follows. A little time ago the Bleeder's London correspondent had this passage. Bottle boy is pianoforte playing at St. Januarius's gallery, with pretty tolerable success. He clears £300 per night. Not bad. This the builder of St. Januarius's gallery plunged to the throat in the conspiracy, met with this piece of news, and observed, with characteristic coarseness, that the Bleeder's London correspondent was a blind ass. Being pressed by a man of spirit to give his reasons for this extraordinary statement, he declared that the gallery, crammed to suffocation, would not hold £200, and that its expenses were, probably, at least half what it did hold. The man of spirit, himself a Lesnevelian, had the gallery measured within a week from that hour, and it would not hold £200. Now, can the poorest capacity doubt that it had been altered in the meantime? And so the conspiracy extends, through every grade of society, down to the condemned criminal in prison, the hangman, and the ordinary. Every famous murderer within the last 10 years has desecrated his last moments by falsifying his confidences imparted specially to the London correspondent of the Lesnevel Bleeder. On every such occasion, Mr. Calcraft has followed the degrading example, and the Reverend Ordinary, forgetful of his cloth, and mindful only, it would seem, alas, of the conspiracy, has committed himself to some account or other of the criminal's demeanor and conversation, which has been diametrically opposed to the exclusive information of the London correspondent of the Bleeder. And this, as has been before observed, is Merry England. A man of true genius, however, is not easily defeated. The Bleeder's London correspondent, probably beginning to suspect the existence of a plot against him, has recently fallen on a new style, which, as being very difficult to countermine, may necessitate the organization of a new conspiracy. One of his masterly letters, lately, disclosed the adoption of this style, which was remarked with profound sensation throughout the Lesnevel in the following passage. Mentioning literary small talk, I may tell you that some new and extraordinary rumors are afloat concerning the conversations I have previously mentioned, alleged to have taken place in the first floor front situated over the street door of Mr. Ten, Amateur the poet so well known to your readers, in which Ten, Amateur's great uncle, his second son, his butcher, and a corpulent gentleman with one eye universally respected at Kensington, are said not to have been on the most friendly footing. I forbear, however, to pursue the subject further this week, my informant not being able to supply me with exact particulars. But, enough, sir. The inhabitant of Tlesnival who has taken pen in hand to expose this odious association of unprincipled men against a shining local character turns from it with disgust and contempt. Let him in few words strip the remaining flimsy covering from the nude object of the conspirators, and his loathsome task is ended. Sir, that object, he contends, is evidently twofold. First, to exhibit the London correspondent of the Tlesnival Bleater in the light of a mischievous blockhead who, by hiring himself out to tell what he cannot possibly know, is as great a public nuisance as a blockhead in a corner can be. Second, to suggest to the men of Tlesnival that it does not improve their town to have so much dry rubbish shot there. Now, sir, on both these points Tlesnival demands in accents of thunder, where is the Attorney General? Why doesn't the Times take it up?
Is the latter in the conspiracy? It never adopts his views, or quotes him, and incessantly contradicts him.
Tlesnival, sir, remembering that our forefathers contended with the Norman at Hastings, and bled at a variety of other places, that will readily occur to you, demands that its birthright shall not be bartered away for a mess of pottage. Have a care, sir, have a care. Or Tlesnival,
its idle rifles piled in its scouted streets,
may be seen ere long, advancing with its bleater to the foot of the throne, and demanding redress for this conspiracy, from the orbed and sceptered hands of majesty itself. The young man from the country, a song of the hour, now in course of being sung and whistled in every street, the other day reminded the writer of these words as he chanced to pass a fag end of the song for the 20th time in a short London walk that 20 years ago, a little book on the United States, entitled American Notes, was published by a young man from the country, who had just seen and left it. This young man from the country fell into a deal of trouble by reason of having taken the liberty to believe that he perceived in America downward popular tendencies for which his young enthusiasm had been anything but prepared. It was in vain for the young man to offer in extenuation of his belief that no stranger could have set foot on those shores with a feeling of livelier interest in the country and stronger faith in it than he. Those were the days when the Tories had made their Ashburton Treaty, and when Whigs and Radicals must have no theory disturbed. All three parties waylaid and mauled the young man from the country, and showed that he knew nothing about the country. As the young man from the country had observed in the preface to his little book that he could bide his time, he took all this in silent part for 8 years. Publishing then a cheap edition of his book, he made no stronger protest than the following. My readers have opportunities of judging for themselves whether the influences and tendencies which I distrusted in America have any existence but in my imagination. They can examine for themselves whether there has been anything in the public career of that country during these past 8 years, or whether there is anything in its present position, at home or abroad, which suggests that those influences and tendencies really do exist. As they find the fact, they will judge me. If they discern any evidences of wrong-going in any direction that I have indicated, they will acknowledge that I had reason in what I wrote. If they discern no such thing, they will consider me altogether mistaken. I have nothing to defend, or to explain away. The truth is the truth, and neither childish absurdities, nor unscrupulous contradictions, can make it otherwise. The earth would still move round the sun, though the whole Catholic Church said no. 12 more years having since passed away, it may now, at last, be simply just towards the young man from the country to compare what he originally wrote with recent events and their plain motive powers. Treating of the House of Representatives at Washington, he wrote thus. Did I recognize in this assembly a body of men who, applying themselves in a new world to correct some of the falsehoods and vices of the old, purified the avenues to public life, paved the dirty ways to plus and power, debated and made laws for the common good, and had no party but their country?
I saw in them the wheels that move the meanest perversion of virtuous political machinery that the worst tools ever wrought. Despicable trickery at elections, underhanded tamperings with public officers, cowardly attacks upon opponents, with scurrilous newspapers for shields and hired pens for daggers, shameful trucklings to mercenary knaves, whose claim to be considered is that every day and week they sow new crops of ruin with their venal types, which are the dragon's teeth of yore, in everything but sharpness, aidings and abettings of every bad inclination in the popular mind, and artful suppressions of all its good influences. Such things as these, and in a word, dishonest faction in its most depraved and most unblushing form, stared out from every corner of the crowded hall. Did I see among them the intelligence and refinement, the true honest patriotic heart of America? Here and there were drops of its blood and life, but they scarcely colored the stream of desperate adventurers which sets that way for profit and for pay. It is the game of these men, and of their profligate organs, to make the strife of politics so fierce and brutal, and so destructive of all self-respect in worthy men, that sensitive and delicate-minded persons shall be kept aloof, and they, and such as they, be left to battle out their selfish views unchecked. And thus this lowest of all scrambling fights goes on, and they who in other countries would, from their intelligence and station, most aspire to make the laws, do here recoil the farthest from that degradation. That there are, among the representatives of the people in both houses, and among all parties, some men of high character and great abilities, I need not say. The foremost among those politicians who are known in Europe have been already described, and I see no reason to depart from the rule I have laid down for my guidance of abstaining from all mention of individuals. It will be sufficient to add that to the most favorable accounts that have been written of them, I fully and most heartily subscribe, and that personal intercourse and free communication have bred within me not the result predicted in the very doubtful proverb, but increased admiration and respect. Towards the end of his book, the young man from the country thus expressed himself concerning its people. They are, by nature, frank, brave, cordial, hospitable, and affectionate. Cultivation and refinement seem but to enhance their warmth of heart and ardent enthusiasm, and it is the possession of these latter qualities in a most remarkable degree which renders an educated American one of the most endearing and most generous of friends. I never was so won upon as by this class, never yielded up my full confidence and esteem so readily and pleasurably as to them. Never can make again, in half a year, so many friends for whom I seem to entertain the regard of half a life. These qualities are natural, I implicitly believe, to the whole people. That they are, however, sadly sapped and blighted in their growth among the mass, and that there are influences at work which endanger them still more, and give but little present promise of their healthy restoration, is a truth that ought to be told. It is an essential part of every national character to pique itself mightily upon its faults, and to deduce tokens of its virtue or its wisdom from their very exaggeration. One great blemish in the popular mind of America, and the prolific parent of an innumerable brood of evils, is universal distrust. Yet the American citizen plumes himself upon this spirit, even when he is sufficiently dispassionate to perceive the ruin it works, and will often adduce it, in spite of his own reason, as an instance of the great sagacity and acuteness of the people, and their superior shrewdness and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.